When the world is calling, whether it's sunny beaches, global cities, or boardrooms that can't wait, getting there starts here. With over 55 nonstop destinations, a new nonstop to Montreal on Air Canada, and 20 nonstop flights a day to New York City, Columbus makes travel simpler, smarter, and closer than you think. Start your trip at flycolumbus.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Epochs! Hello and welcome back to Epochs. I shall be continuing the story this week all about the life of Henry VI, the little baby, or the little boy, the young man now, as I'll start telling the story, the little baby of Henry V. If you remember last time, Henry V had died at an inopportune moment in the middle of the wars of the Hundred Years' War, and left his younger brothers to look after his baby son, who's now growing up. If you remember last time I finished off, last thing I said, I think, was talking about how Henry VI had been married to one Margaret of Anjou when he was still in his teens. So we'll pick up the story there. I'll be reading from Professor Sir Charles Omon and Sir Winston Churchill, The History of the English-Speaking Peoples. And the thing we'll have to start getting into this week, which is really the story of the Wars of the Roses, is the family tree. Now, it's quite complicated. At various times, we should put up an image showing the family tree to help it make sense, because it is quite complicated. But basically, bear this in mind the whole time, is that nearly everyone involved in this are cousins. Sometimes the Wars of the Roses are called the Cousin Wars. And this is it in a nutshell. There'll be lots and lots of characters here, lots and lots of different people. And I'll try and explain it as best I can and try and keep reminding you who's who and who's related to who. But it is complicated. But in a nutshell, this is what it is. Okay. The old king, Edward III, had quite a few children. And they themselves had quite a few children. And when it gets to the point where Henry VI is very, very weak, there's just lots of different branches of the same family that all think they should really be the king instead of him. Because if you remember last time I mentioned, didn't I, and I've talked about before, how Henry IV, Henry V's father, our Henry VI's grandfather, had deposed Richard II in 1399. So Edward III's children, his oldest son, Edward, the Black Prince, that Richard II, who was probably starved to death, he was the only son of the Black Prince. So that whole line is finished. The legit, perfectly legit line ended there. So then it's up for grabs, really. I mean, the next son, Lionel, Duke of Clarence, his family goes through the Mortimers, the Mortimer line, and on to the Duke of York, Richard, Duke of York, part of the Mortimer line. That's the next son down, descended from Lionel, Duke of Clarence. And to make all these things more complicated, being the Duke of York had passed between various parts of the family over a generation or two as well, which makes it even more confusing. But anyway, Richard, Duke of York, will come up here. And, you know, he can legitimately claim that he's got a very, very good right to be the king, because Henry IV and Henry V and now Henry VI, they're all descended from the third son of Edward III, John of Gaunt. Then there's other members, there's other branches of the family as well, the Beauforts. They come down through another son of Edward III, the Edmund, Duke of York. And there's even more. The Somersets are part of the Beaufort line. So there's all different families, okay? And they all think, and they've all got the blood royal, so to speak. And they all think that it's not necessarily right that the young man, Henry VI, has got the best claim. Okay, so let me pick up the story, reading from Sir Charles Omon, just after the point where he's married to Margaret of Anjou. Okay, so Charles Omon says, Gloucester and Richard of York saluted this wise marriage and treaty with loud cries of wrath. So they didn't like it. Remember, Gloucester is one of Henry IV's younger brothers and meant to be regent in England and meant to be the protector of the young Henry VI. And Richard, Duke of York, is an uncle, basically an uncle, a cousin, a branch of the same family. Okay. And he's extremely powerful. He's one of the most powerful men in the whole country. Rich and powerful, able to raise many, many men from his own purse and got giant influence. Okay, that's Richard, Duke of York. Gloucester and Richard, Duke of York, they said that the Earl of Suffolk, who negotiated it, the marriage between Henry VI and Margaret of Anjou, they said that he must have been sold to France. He was working on behalf of France. This helps France. This helps Anjou. Why didn't we marry him to an English girl? Oh, princess, duchess. And spoke of the surrender of the fortresses of Maine as treason to the English crown. The greater part of the nation believed them to be right, for Humphrey, the Duke of Gloucester, and Richard were both popular with the masses, and it soon became a matter of faith that the Beauforts and Suffolks had betrayed their young master. So as you can see, the various branches, cousin branches, cadet branches of what was the House of Plantagenet, now breaking apart and forming factions, both accusing each other of not doing what's in the best interests of the kingdom and Henry, the king. Oman goes on saying, a strong king might have crushed this unwise opposition to peace, but Henry VI, who had now passed his majority, he was 18, was anything but a strong king. He was frail and feeble both in body and mind, a simple soul, much given to exercises of piety and to quiet study. He always sought some stronger arm on which to lean, and when he had chosen his friends, wisely or unwisely, he clung to them with the obstinacy that so often accompanies weakness. Worst of all, he had inherited a taint of madness from his grandfather, the insane King Charles VI of France, and from time to time his brain was clouded by fits of apathetic melancholy. Now that's a way of saying a type of selective mutism. It seems that he would sometimes just stop speaking, just not say anything at all. People would ask him questions and he would just refuse to say anything. Or even something a bit worse than that, according to various accounts, that he was sort of semi-comatose, that his eyes were open, right? And he would eat. If you put something in his hand, a fork or a spoon with food in it, he would eat it. If you put food in his mouth, he would chew it and eat it. But beyond that, would just stare into nothingness all day, every day. You could sort of walk him towards the bed and put him in bed and he'd lay down. You could sort of get him out of bed and put him in a chair. You could move him around, manipulate him a bit. He would eat, right? But he wouldn't say anything and he would just stare into blankness, just stare at the wall, right? And it's not some sort of clever ploy. It's that he's got a mental illness. Okay, so an apathetic melancholy. And sometimes if he wasn't completely suffering from that, sometimes it was something very, very close to that. So occasionally he would sort of murmur, okay, or no, or yes or no. But, you know, 99% of the time, just say nothing, do nothing. So it's a real problem. That's terrible to have that when you're the king in medieval times. That's nowhere near good enough. That's disastrous. So even if he was a normal person like you or I, that had their own mind and was prepared to stand up for themselves to some extent sometimes, even that's not good enough. To be a normal person in the 21st century, like you or I, that's far too weak still. We would be considered far too weak. You need to be a crazily headstrong warrior, really. Like a badass butcher type person. Henry V, a massive character, a super, super strong personality and will, a will of iron. Right, so this apathetic melancholy, that is terrible. You're going to be manipulated. You'll immediately become someone or some faction's bitch. They will make you a puppet and they will move you around like you're nothing, like you're just a chess piece on their board. It's the worst thing. Okay, I think you get it. Oman continues saying here, Henry had learnt to trust his great uncle, Cardinal Beaufort, and his minister, Suffolk. He would never listen to any accusation against them. His views were shared by the fiery young queen, who soon began to rule him by dint of her stronger will. So just quickly to say about this sort of selective mutism and staring just into nothing for days on end, all day, every day, for days, weeks, or months on end. That actually came and went. That's not what he was like all the time. So sometimes he would be sort of normal, effectively normal, although he was still weak and pious. You know, sometimes he was like that. And then sometimes he would go through these episodes, which could last weeks or months, of the full-blown selective mutism staring into space. So, okay, it wasn't like he wasn't like that 100% of the time. It came and went. But as I say, even when he wasn't suffering from those episodes, he was still weak-willed, weak-minded, and inclined to let people walk all over him or be completely dominated by his wife or by one or two of his favourites. As it said there, Cardinal Beaufort or the Earl of Suffolk. And so, of course, those people form a faction, right? They realise that their main card, the main reason why, well, the only reason they're in power, so to speak, is because Henry likes them, because Henry has picked them to be his controllers, effectively. So they want to keep it that way. Anyone else, like Richard Duke of York, perhaps, that would like to wrest Henry VI out of their control, out of their grasp, and start manipulating him for himself, they don't want that to happen, obviously, because it's not in their interests. So political factions grow up for and against the king and his supporters, his clique of powerful people. Okay, Oman goes on after just saying there that his wife, Margaret of Anjou, ruled him by dint of her stronger will. She is a very, very strong woman, very, very strong-minded, the opposite of a shrinking violet, but we'll get into all of that. Oman continues here saying, the truce of Tours, i.e. the peace between England and France, lasted for some 5 years. During this space, the factions in England grew fiercer than ever, and in 1447 came to a head. At a parliament at Bury St. Edmunds, Gloucester was suddenly arrested by order of Suffolk and the Queen and charged with treason. So that's a big thing. Gloucester's like the uncle of the king and supposed to be, basically, the regent of England. He's sort of supposed to be king in all but name. You heard last episode, he was actually not a very good ruler and he was weak and he had crazy harebrained ideas and fell in love and fell out of love and tried foreign adventures that failed and all that sort of thing. So it's not like he's a great shining example of leadership or anything. But nonetheless, the fact that Suffolk and Margaret of Anjou just have him arrested because he was one of the leaders of the sort of the anti-king faction. Well, it's not even the king. Everyone knows the king is weak and a puppet. So the king himself personally is, you know, not really particularly much of this. It's just who can nominally claim to be controlling him. But okay, Suffolk and the Queen just arrested Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester. And so, you know, and so that whole faction is taking a massive hit there. Includes Richard, Duke of York and Cardinal Beaufort. He died within a few days, the Duke of Gloucester. Right, okay. Probably from an apoplectic seizure and not from any foul play. Well, we just don't know, do we? It's always suspicious when someone's arrested and died of natural causes in custody within days. Did they? But okay, most historians do think it just, in this case anyway, it may well have been natural causes, but I'm always very, very suspicious about that sort of thing. Okay, Oman goes on saying, but it was natural that the rumour should get abroad that Suffolk had secretly murdered him. Gloucester was only outlived for a few months by his lifelong rival, the old Cardinal Beaufort. Their deaths cleared the way for the rise of new men. The Cardinal's place at the head of the peace party was taken by Suffolk and Edmund Beaufort, Duke of Somerset, men of far lower stamp than the old churchman, who, though proud and worldly, had always done his best to serve England. Suffolk and Somerset were busy, self-important, self-seeking men, and coveted power and office for their own private ends. The Duke of York, who succeeded to Duke Humphrey's position, was a far more capable man, but he was committed to the hopeless, unpractical programme of perpetual war with France. So just to say, Richard, Duke of York, now comes onto the scene in a much bigger way. And he is pretty badass. He's much more in the vein of Henry V or the Duke of Bedford, someone like that. He can and does fight battles, personally fighting battles, got a very, very, very strong personality, bull-headed, super strong will type guy. You know, he's hard as nails. And so battle lines are starting to be drawn politically at this point, politically. You know, Suffolk and Margaret of Anjou on one side and the Duke of York and various others on the other. And the Duke of York is basically sort of taken the position of one of the most, if not the most powerful man in the country, not exactly regent, because the king is now old enough. Technically, he's in his majority. Technically, he's a grown-up now, the king. He's actually a man at this point. But nonetheless, there'll be people in Parliament that could really wield much more power than the king. Or someone like Margaret of Anjou will try to wield power through the king. You know, she'll say, or Suffolk will say, the king says this, the king decrees this, the king wants X, Y, Z. Actually, the king's done nothing. He's sitting there in silence. It's them. It's them. And so it's down to other people, someone like Richard, Duke of York, to say, wait a minute, no, is it? Let's, you know, come on. What's going on? Sort of thing. Haven't you just arrested the Duke of Gloucester and now he's suddenly died? Like, what? Are you guys acting as tyrants? Okay. Omar goes on here saying, his position, that of Duke of York, his position too was rendered difficult by the fact that Duke Humphrey's death had made him next heir to the throne after the feeble young king. As I mentioned, Duke of York is descended through Clarence, Edward III's second son, Clarence, i.e. an older brother than John of Gaunt. I mean, there's an argument to be made that this Richard Duke of York should just be king. Not that he's next after Henry VI. He just should be king now. Okay, there's an argument, a fairly strong argument, but okay. For there was now no other male of the House of Lancaster surviving. The Queen, Suffolk and Somerset began to look on him with suspicion, and he had to walk warily lest charges of treason should be brought against him, as they had been against his cousin, Gloucester. Meanwhile, he was fain to accept the position of Lord Deputy of Ireland, which kept him out of harm's way. So he knew, as strong as he is, he knew that the party of power, Suffolk and Margaret of Anjou, that he is Henry's mate there, and therefore their main rival. If anyone would want to usurp the king, it would be Richard Duke of York. So, okay, they make him Lord Deputy of Ireland, which means you do have to go out to Ireland, sort of rule Ireland, or big parts of it anyway. So he's sort of out of harm's way, effectively, Omar says. Okay, he continues saying, in 1449, the truce with France, which had accompanied the king's marriage, was broken by the gross fault of his minister Suffolk. Some of the Norman garrisons were left so long unpaid that they broke into mutiny, crossed the border, and sacked the rich Breton town of Fourgres. Probably mispronouncing that. Failing to get satisfaction from Suffolk for this outrage, Charles VII, the King of France, declared war. Normandy was now in the charge of Somerset, a man of very different calibre from Richard of York, who had held it against such odds in the days before the Truce of Tours. The French, on invading the duchy, swept the English before them with an ease that astonished even themselves. The peasants and townsfolk rose against their masters on every side and gave the invaders their best help, the French, that is. Town after town fell. Rouen, the capital of the duchy, was betrayed by traitors within the gates, and the unhappy Somerset had to fall back on Caen. That town, with Cherbourg and Harfleur, was soon all remaining to the English on Norman soil. So the tide of the Hundred Years' War has very, very much turned in favour of the French and against the English. We're now on the back foot, and have been for quite a while now, right? We haven't really been on the front foot since the first few years after Henry V's death, but it's all starting to truly collapse now. And in fact, it all does start imploding with increasing speed. Omar says, this terrible news stirred up great wrath and indignation in England against Suffolk and Somerset, because they were supposed to be in charge. An army was hastily got ready at Portsmouth and sent over to Cherbourg with orders to join Somerset at Caen. But the French threw themselves between and forced the army of succour to give them battle at Formigny. At this disastrous fight, well nigh the whole English force was destroyed, overwhelmed by an attack from the rear at a moment when it was already engaged with the superior French army in front. Only its general, Sir Thomas Kyriel, and 400 men were granted quarter, while no less than 3,000 were slain, and that was in April 1450. This disaster settled the fate of Normandy. Somerset was compelled to surrender Caen and returned, covered with ignominy, to England. The other garrisons yielded one after another, and nothing remained of all the mighty conquests of Henry V in northern France. End quote. So just to remind you, we've been fighting on and off, the English and the French have been fighting on and off for northern France, whether it's Normandy, Picardy, Maine, all parts of France, for centuries and centuries. You know, it's been back and forth. William the Conqueror, a Norman, conquers England, But then not that long after, a few generations later, we've got someone like a figure like Henry II, who controls all of it himself. And then during the ages of Richard the Lionheart and John, we win some, we lose some. During the age of Edward I, we win some, we lose some. During the age of Edward III, we win a lot. We get it all back, keep it for a few generations. Then we lose some again. Then Henry V turns up and we win it all again. And now we've lost it all again, nearly all again. So it just goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. This is a period where the English lose it, nearly all of it. Okay. And it's not that long ago, is it? It's only a generation ago that we'd won it all in glory under Henry V. Sort of a glorious high tide, one of the high watermarks. And, you know, within one generation, it's all lost again. Okay. Let Oman go on again. He continues. He says, even before Formigny had been fought, i.e. the battle where the English lost and the French won, or Caen had fallen, grave troubles had broken out in England. Okay, so it's all starting. The real Wars of the Roses, basically, or the very first kernels of it, really, sort of begin at this stage. You know, it's easy to think of it as that the Hundred Years' War peters out or ends, and all that energy, if you like, is transferred in on itself, blasts in on itself in England. Yeah, all that sort of martial energy is focused inwards and becomes an internal war, the Wars of the Roses, the Cousins' War. All the families, all the rich and powerful people that should have been winning in their own eyes, should have been winning glorious Edward III, Henry V style victories in France. Well, they can't do that now, so they all turn on each other, basically. There's obviously more to it than that, but you know, you can think of it that way a bit. We hope you enjoyed that video, and if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.
When the world is calling, whether it's sunny beaches, global cities, or boardrooms that can't wait, getting there starts here. With over 55 nonstop destinations, a new nonstop to Montreal on Air Canada, and 20 nonstop flights a day to New York City, Columbus makes travel simpler, smarter, and closer than you think. Start your trip at flycolumbus.com.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.